Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talks and Tales. You are joined for the last episode of the year by Daisy and Tess. Hope you've all had a wonderful week and are keen for our very last ep. Anyway, Daisy, how are you? Are you pretty excited for this last one?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like we've had some really incredible guests on this year and like a huge variety of topics that we've been able to cover. But like we always say, podcasting is a lot of fun, but it comes with a fair bit of work as well. So it's quite nice to just have a bit of a break over Chrissy and into the new year, and then hopefully give us a little bit more kind of like inspiration and motivation for next year as well, because it's obviously something we love doing, we want to continue doing. So we've recently had a couple of people in our DMs letting us know and asking for some particular topics or guests, and yeah, we really, really like appreciate people who send in those ideas, because we want to know what you want to hear about. It's quite difficult to make sure that we make it varied and that we're covering a lot of different topics, but we love the community that we're working and the community that Tess and I have been able to build through this podcast. So yeah, if anyone ever has any ideas, please shoot through a message. Doesn't matter if you think they're silly, they're probably not. And we'd love to hear from you guys all the time.
Yeah, definitely. I think we both, as much as we love this podcast, we both love a break too. And it gives us a bit more inspiration to be like, oh yeah, and get a bit more excited about it. Like, you know, distance makes the heart grow fonder. We have a bit of time to think of different topics, or maybe have a few people reach out to us as well in that time as well. So yeah, get excited for next year, guys. It's going to be good.
Yes. Like Daisy said. Yeah, I agree. Do you have any fun Christmas plans, Tess? What have you got going on?
No, not really. I'm really excited to have Indy's first Christmas, obviously. So just seeing family. I think everyone understands the Christmas scramble. Hey, it's like this person's house this day, this person's house Boxing Day, like that. So it's going to be a bit bonkers, but it is what it is, and it's going to be fun. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be so special for like Indy's first Christmas. I can't believe she's 6 months old already. It's insane how fast that's gone.
Yes, time has absolutely flown. What about you, Daisy?
I think it's going to be a pretty quiet one this year. My husband's working all day Christmas Day, so I'm probably going to hang out with my bestie, with Deli, and hang out with her and be a part of her family for a bit. Because my family obviously all in the UK, so we're going to do Christmas here a couple of days later just so that we can all be together. But yeah, like I agree with you, this week we've got a work Christmas party tomorrow night, and then me and you, we have our girls' Christmas Day party Friday, which would be so fun. I'm really excited to see you and see the girls and spend some quality time with you all. But yeah, it definitely feels a bit hectic. And then with work, it's just like, oh, school holidays brings even more hecticness. And I always resent the people that are like, oh, just hold out to the end of the year, you know, it's all good. And then we've got 2 weeks to chill off with Christmas, which you can fully relate to this year because you're going to get all that lovely time off. But for us, generally, most of the time for you, it is like our hectic time of year and we get one day off and you're like, okay, no worries. So yeah, it's not really a relaxing time of year, but you know, Christmas is my favorite time of year for sure. So there's always a lot of good things that come to.
Absolutely. And Daisy is currently sitting in Christmas pajamas for this podcast. So yes. If only you could see it, I'll take a photo and put it on the
my Disney Christmas pajamas, actually.
Anyway, did you want to tell us who is joining us on this last ep?
Yes, we have an absolute banger. We are interviewing and chatting with Brandon Gifford. He is such a legend. I had the pleasure of working with Giffo at the zoo. We worked in roving together for a fair few years and kind of grew up together, I guess, in our very first roles within the industry. So he is an absolute inspiration. He's such a legend. He's gone on to do some really amazing things with reptiles. He's so passionate and definitely someone that I feel like everyone listening can definitely learn some stuff from. So we love chatting to him, and I'm sure you guys are going to love listening to him too. So let's get into it. Giffo, thank you so much for joining us on Trainer Talks and Tales. We are so excited to finish the year chatting to you.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here. Been waiting for this, and we're finishing the year off with me, you poor people.
No, we're excited. We're excited. Sure. But yeah, before we go into our questions, we do start every episode with a fast five. So are you happy if we get straight into that?
Oh, go for it. Absolutely.
All right. Okay, cool. All right, starting off, question number one. What is your favourite bird species?
Favourite bird species are emu. Yeah.
Bucket list destination.
Oh, gosh. Madagascar.
Komodos or crocs?
Oh, you were joking. Crocs, but Komodos are far out. I should say Komodos, but crocs. Yeah.
Pepsi or Coke?
Pepsi Max. Mm.
Yeah, agree. And finally, what is your favourite snake species?
Inland taipan. Don't even have to think about him.
Nice. Good job. That was a great start. Giffo, we would love to share with the listeners kind of a little bit more about what your career has looked like, where you started, how you progressed, and what you're kind of looking at doing or what you're doing right now as well.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we kind of met right at the start. Like, I guess I start off as a 14-year-old as my first zoo, well, like first time working in a facility was at Currumbin as a little four, or I guess all you can do as a 14-year-old is a work experience and volunteer at Currumbin Wildlife Sanctuary on the Gold Coast. And that was phenomenal. It was unreal. Like, I grew up my whole life, like we all did in the zoo industry, I feel like, obsessed with wildlife. I was very lucky to grow up in country New South Wales. So there was a lot of snakes at my disposal, a lot of goannas, a lot of lizards. But I think my first real taste of zoo keeping was at Currumbin Wildlife Sanctuary. That was the closest park to home. And then from Currumbin, TAFE sent me up to Australia Zoo and started working there while I was in uni, just volunteering as well. But eventually went from volunteering to a job, and that was in roving. And that's where Dazo and I started working together.
Yeah.
I think I've been there a year or two before you started. And then, Roving Entertainment Australia Zoo, which was great because I think roving, if you're in the zoo industry, you've worked as a keeper, you understand that there's so many aspects to it. But one common theme that you hear from a lot of animal people is, I love animals and I hate people, I can't stand them. And I think far out, the zoo industry is not the right one for you because you're about to work with, I don't know, some zoos, 500 staff or 30, but people every single day. And then, of course, the hundreds, if not thousands of zoo visitors and up to hundreds of thousands you'll interact with year round. So I guess to solidify your people skills and working around people, roving was a really good foundation for myself and for you and everyone else that has been a rover. I think it's really the most important thing to be able to communicate what we do with other people. So I start off in that. Moved from roving. My passion was reptiles. Wasn't getting it quick enough at the zoo, so I moved south to the Australian Reptile Park. Actually met my now fiance Alicia at the Australian Reptile Park, and I told her how good Australia Zoo was, and she left, which was a terrible mistake of mine because then we had to do long distance for a few years. But and she went up to be a mammal keeper. But I should say, while I was at the zoo, I was also a mammal keeper. And I did a bit of birds with Dazo as well when she was in birds.
Oh, yeah.
But mainly stuck to my mammals, and wombats was a big passion. But yeah, down at the reptile park, which trade into reptiles, as a senior reptile and spider keeper. So that's part of all the reptile collection there, including Elvis, the big croc. And then the Komodos, of course, and the Komodos were a great focus at the start to try and breed them. And then just briefly past that, left the park. To follow Leashy Babe back up to the Sunny Coast and start working at Australia Zoo again as a reptile keeper this time. And then after that, our good mate Stu McKenzie up there poached me in true snake catcher style from the zoo to the snake catchers, the Sunshine Coast snake catchers. And I was only in there for 12 months before Tim Faulkner from the Reptile Park called us up and said, hey, we want you on the Central Coast. Can you come down and be the ops manager? There's a position. And God, Stu didn't like that, and I was a bit sort of not sure what I was going to do, but I couldn't turn it down. You can't turn an opportunity like that down in the zoo industry. They come very few and far between, so we're back down here.
It's so insane listening to your whole history, and like, feel so privileged to have been able to share some of your career with you. And like, we learned so much as like little baby rovers compared to, you know, where we are now and how much progression we've made, and especially you. It's been incredible following your journey. And it's so inspirational as well.
Oh, thanks, Daisy. Oh, it's so much fun. I still think our funnest times, even though we didn't know it at the time, were as rovers, like at the start there. We had all the parties and all the good times. It was really good.
Yeah,
Yeah.
the
You don't
5,000
realize how
people shows. It was so fun presenting with you. Yeah, it was a good time.
And we thought we had a big, busy day back then, and now I'm like, holy hell.
I didn't even know you were a rover, so there you go. I've learned something new.
I know. I only did it for a little bit. It was like the first 3 years, but mainly that, and then I think mammal keeping kind of took over. Yeah.
I actually really liked that you mentioned how important people skills or having that interaction with people is, and that really resonates with me because I think a lot of us do say, oh, I love animals, I don't really do people. And you're right, like, look, that's a really big part of our job. So I'm actually really glad that you pointed that out. So that was well said, Giffo.
Oh, thank you. And you're like your good mate and Dazo's good mate and my good mate Olivia was probably the best for at the start to have her as a mentor and a coach for like interacting with those people but engaging them through the talks and the shows. Like she's the absolute best teacher to have for communication. So I think that helped me along the road a lot. But yeah, it is so true because like we're going to communicate a message. We focus so much on the animals, and I see the most animally people that can't stand people ended up being some of the best people you'll ever meet, because they work in the zoo industry. But yeah, it's definitely something you just got to grit your teeth and get through, and eventually it becomes very easy. Yeah.
Definitely. Now, can you tell us a little bit more about your role at ARP and what it entails?
Yeah, the new job's a bit more full on. It's operations manager. So we've already got a bit of a structure at the park. Obviously, we've got the owners slash directors, and then like every zoo, we've got a curator. So we've got a curator of life sciences, Hayley Shute. And then we've got under that we've got Bill and me. So Bill's the park manager, Bill Collette, and he's very well known because of his work in the industry, and he's had a long running history with the park and the venom program in Australia. He's also worked with a lot of crocs up north. He's a bloody weapon with reptiles. But yeah, Bill was already the ops manager. It's a massive role, and the park is growing very rapidly, so they wanted to split that role, divide it up. But Bill, of course, like not on the same level to him. We both fall under Hayley, but I fall under him as well. So I talk to both of those in my day. But operations manager, my day to day is just looking after all the teams, like make sure that reptiles are all good, spiders, venom, mammals and birds, maintenance, every aspect of a park. So yeah, it's fast paced. It's a bit more boots on the ground, which I love. And so you get out there, and oh, it's ridiculous for no day ever being the same at the moment. It is nuts. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a really cool role that you've taken on, and it encompasses so many different things and so many new learnings, I can imagine as well. One thing like I'd love to know, and obviously you kind of touched on it slightly before, you were at Australia Zoo, you opted to move to the ARP, which not necessarily was something that you kind of wanted to do, but opportunities weren't coming up for you. So how did you find making that decision to know when it was the right time to move on to progress how you
It's
going with your career?
how funny is it? Because you were there when this was happening. We were working together, and I was telling you my frustrations of not getting to where I wanted to go. Certainly not as quickly. God, and I think when you know where you want to be and what you want to do, like it's even more frustrating when you can't get there quick. So it's driving me insane. But the more I go on, the more I realize that most young people in the zoo industry, pretty well everyone has a story very similar where these blocks just get put straight in the way. So at the start there, I was told never be a reptile keeper. Like you won't make it. You're too much of a put on. You're trying to be Steve. Like you've got all the wrong qualities for what we want in a reptile keeper. And it ended up taking me like job interview after job interview there relentlessly pushing. And eventually I did get a job. And then the carpet just got stripped straight out from under me. An old manager that's no longer in the industry anymore just decided they didn't want me in reptiles. They wanted me to stay right where I was in roving and mammals. So that's when I kind of needed that kick because I wasn't going anywhere. I was set that I was going to work at the zoo. And the reason being was because I think so many young reptile guys like share that passion for crocs. Like crocs are the pinnacle, I guess, of reptiles. And so you always want to work with them. But I was convinced I never wanted to work with them in a farm. I'd never, ever had any interest in farming. I hate it. So if you're going to work with more than one croc in captivity in a zoo in Australia, it's Australia Zoo. And so I really was set on there, but also the standards. And it is a phenomenal place. So really big, a great place to get foundations. But, yeah, just at the time there was someone there that was holding me back. And so I couldn't. So as soon as this opportunity at ARP showed its face, I applied for it. I didn't think I'd get it because it was a senior and hadn't even been a reptile keeper at that point. But I think that's a good example I use to some of the guys like that are really wondering what to do, like what's the next step. It's just aim high, just go for it. There's no harm in failing. In fact, fail many times. It took me 14 job interviews before I got my first reptile gig. And that's just reptile job interviews. So, and at the start, as I said, told you'll never do it. So it can be brutal and it can break you. I think you remember the time that job got ripped out from under me. I was devastated. And now I look back on it and go, far out. You were so upset for what that was. But it really is at that age. It's crushing. But you just ignore it. And then you're like, you know where you want to be, so no one can stop you. And it's so good now. It taught, I would never take that back because it taught me so much resilience. And I think that's an important, if you're going to be in the zoo industry, you want that resilience muscle nice and strong.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I think you have set such an incredible example. And to people listening, that it's not like, you know, you can't expect to get everything handed to you on a plate. And there is still a lot of hard work that goes into this industry and being able to progress into roles that you want to. And even if that moves means changing states or changing facilities, there's so many different things that you have to do. And you've really set such a good example of being able to prove that, hey, now people are like wanting you and you don't even have to ask, they're like approaching you. Like, how amazing, like this whole like 180 that you've been able to do. So it's really inspirational.
And one thing I would say though is that once I started getting job offers, it still didn't sink in. I was still in the old mindset that I had of like, yeah, you're never going to be like at that level because all my mates get job offers. Like, look at Dan. He's a great comparison zookeeper, Dan. Like, everyone knows him. He made a name for himself and he's a legend and he deserves it. But I worked very closely with him and you could see the offers coming through. And I thought, that happens to people like that. It doesn't happen to you. But then when it starts happening, it is really good. And that actually happens a bit sooner than you expect. So I think people just need to like really hang in there because I've seen so many people that were so close to getting where they were going to be give up and leave, and they should ride it out. And yeah, I think if you can move, it does help. It's like just helps you sort of jump up the steps. Yeah.
Well, interestingly, when you said that at the start, we have had guests in the past say sometimes the younger generation can be a bit like, I want this, I want to be in there, da, 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 da. And they don't do the time, or they maybe are a bit, you know, vocal as to what they want. And that has been something that, you know, everyone sees at different facilities. But I think the fact that you wanted something with a lot of passion, it was different because you know, not only talk the talk, you walk the walk and you did that many interviews. It's different when people stay at the same facility and pipe up that they want something, but aren't really, you know, like you said, moving to other facilities, moving to other states, doing, how many interviews did you say you did? A lot.
Yeah, 14. For that one role was 14, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's important to highlight that you weren't just piping up at the one facility saying, I want this. It was like, okay, I'm not getting it here. Let me branch out. So good on you. You got there. And look at you now.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think that's important for the young guys that are on socials in particular, is they watch keepers, and it is a great highlight reel of what we do. But it is just a highlight reel. Like, it doesn't scratch the surface. It's like the 2% of a crocodile with its eyes above the water. It is not what you've done to get to where you are. And they don't see that, and they can't see that because we don't share that side of things. We don't share. Actually, first time I've ever publicly told that story of the zoo. But, we don't share that with people. We only share it with our tight-knit little close group of what it actually takes to become a keeper. So the young guys just don't, I guess, expect it. They think they see us get it and they go, oh, far out, I should be where he is. I'm just as passionate. I've grown up loving reptiles. I've got all the ingredients, so why aren't I there? And you go, mate, like you've got to hit your head up against a brick wall several times to get to where you want to go. So, but and sometimes it works out perfectly. Sometimes you're born Neuro Rocher and your mum sends you to the zoo and you get a job. Like it's not always the same for everyone, but it certainly doesn't help. And that's not a dig at Nero. Nero's the best keeper there is for his attitude.
You got to kiss a few frogs to get to where you want to
Bloody oath, that is the best saying.
get to. All right, well, off the topic of frogs, let's go back to snakes and spiders. ARP plays a huge role in the anti-venom program for both those snakes and spiders. But for the creatures involved, can you chat a little bit more about ensuring that they have a high level of welfare as the other animals at the park?
Yeah, and you know what's amazing is that we're doing this podcast in 2 days' time. On Thursday, the brand new Venom Center, Weigel Venom Center, opens. So it's the
Ooh.
first time in the world that a venom facility can be viewed as visiting a zoo, where you can get to just come and watch the work being done. So they can see the standards for themselves. The old building is old. It was built in the at the end of the 90s, and yeah, the enclosures are okay. They're fine. Like they're just a stock standard snake enclosure. But this new facility, we really wanted to just, I guess, bring it forward even further and make them even bigger. So, looking after reptile welfare is a huge passion for all of us. But particularly those that are doing something like the Venom program, that is a huge importance because we have to keep so many animals to do that job. So for milking snakes, there's a several aspects people come at you with welfare. Obviously the enclosure size is important. So we try to we well we do we meet the enclosure size for a snake perfectly, and these new banks are like double the size anyway. So we've really doubled what we wanted for that. But as far as day-to-day husbandry of the reptiles, we've got state-of-the-art systems as far as all of our thermostats are checked by a team every single day. We're constantly in there. We have a venom team that's just dedicated to looking after the venom facility. Feeding requirements, getting them out, just making sure they're getting adequate UV as well. Like that's a huge consideration that wasn't thought of for years. UV on snakes just wasn't a thing. But that's really the last 5 years has been a massive thing, particularly in Australia, that we're starting to put UV over our snakes. Because what do snakes do every day? They bask and they absorb that UV, and it gives them good, strong skin, scales, and bones. So they really need it. But getting to the venom side of it, as far as the extraction of venom, I had a fella say to me once that, oh, I could never work in the venom program. I'd never do that, just because, like, this is a fellow zookeeper, because of what you have to do to the snakes. It's so cruel that you have to grab them and pin them and all that. And you know what? In a perfect world, I guess we wouldn't have a venom program, but it's not a perfect world. People are getting bitten by snakes. There's about 300 to 500 highly venomous snake bites a year, let alone the rest. And these are people that are going to die without a venom program. Like back in the pre-50s, if you were bitten by a tiger snake, there was a 50% chance you weren't going to make it. And if it was a taipan, there was a 100% chance you weren't going to make it. There's only one bloke that survived a coastal taipan bite without anti-venom. So pretty well, odds were stacked on that you weren't going to make it. So they had to devise a plan to extract venom from snakes. Now, if you're a redback spider, that venom is extracted after they kill it, which is not something we do at the park. We milk funnel web spiders, but we refuse to do redbacks just because of the principle of it. But as far as extracting venom from snakes, it's pretty simple. Get them to do something they naturally already do. So as far as the handling, it takes a while for you to become a handler in venom. It really does. You have to prove yourself in the handling of the other snakes in the park, and then you work your way up. So venom has got a bit of a hierarchy there, and it always has, and it's where the keepers aspire to be as far as reptile keepers. You ask any reptile keeper at the park, they want to work in venom. It's like feeding crocs at the Stray Zoo. So you have to work your way up. You have to prove yourself. So by the time you're there handling the snakes, you're already good at it. You're already fluid and you've got it down pat. And then as far as actually pinning the reptiles, that's very gently done. Very gently. It's done on a pillow, like a mat, but it's a very soft sponge. So the snake actually can depress into the mat as you push it down. But what's deceptive about it is it has a clear coat over the top. We put a very thin film of plastic over the top, and that's just purely to slow the snake down from bouncing off the mat, which can become dangerous to the handler as they touch it. So, yeah, pinning, it's probably the part that everyone gets upset. But as far as gliding your fingers up along either side of the snake, running your finger along the spine and holding it behind the head, it couldn't be any more gentle. And it's the exact same method you would use to restrain a snake in a veterinary procedure. So we only do it once every 2 weeks, and the day after they are milked, they get fed straight away. So that's like just to make sure that they're healthy and happy, and yeah, they live a good life. And we do retire them after a while. Once they're older and they're starting to show natural signs that they're slowing down, like with any of them, we just stop using them.
It's really interesting actually hearing you explain it thoroughly, because I think sometimes people's misconceptions of the process is because they just don't know enough information about it. And honestly, like I didn't really know that much information about it either. So it's really interesting for you to explain that process really thoroughly. And like you mentioned, you know, unfortunately, like we're in a world where snakes are becoming more urban, people are coming across them more, and we have to implement ways in regards to being able to save people's lives, which it's obviously been so incredibly effective for. So it's really interesting hearing that, and that you also still carry the welfare of those animals highly, because I think sometimes people can probably get a bit confused between the snakes are here to serve a job, but they're still animals that are home to the park, and they're still treated the same as all the animals, all the other animals ARP as well.
And I don't, this wouldn't be the reason that they did it. Like the Weigels have pretty well, like it was the Worrell, like Eric Worrell and his wife that were really pioneering the venom program in Australia. And they eventually, like John Weigel took over, and Robin, who was originally Robin Worrell, become Robin Weigel. And she has been with it for years. They have really wanted to show it off for years as well. And I guess, like, it's not the reason they did it, but it really shows there is nothing to hide with the venom program. We want people to be able to come to actively see the process and see how it's done for themselves, because it is phenomenal. It's really, I think it's going to be a massive draw card to the Central Coast that you can just come and watch it, purely because, well, it's the only one of its kind in Australia as well. We're the only place in Australia that milks terrestrial venomous snakes for the venom program to save lives. But I think what my favourite part of the venom program is that you're using snakes to save people that have been bitten by snakes. So it really helps that we sort of create the issue of being around snakes all the time and interacting with them. And most of the bites, as we already know, you've preached it a million times before. I think it's something like crazy, like 96 to 98% of the bites on any given year are because people are trying to kill them, or they're like us, they're handling them. So really, when is that down to the snake's fault at all? It's not. But yeah, there are very few bites that occur in Australia where a person isn't trying to interact with them. And then sometimes there just is that occasional slip up where someone stands on one. Or a mate on April Fool's Day this year, I didn't even believe him in casino, thought he was picking up a fence post, got bitten by a brown snake, didn't realise it until later on, and he passed out unconscious. They took him to the hospital, tested his blood, and he had brown snake venom in him. So he survived, but just random stuff like that. So the anti-venom is just an incredible lifesaver. The only other welfare issue that is something people ask us every day at the park is about the horses, because snake venom is injected into horses over an 18-month period to build up the antibodies in them. And it's actually quite phenomenal when you think about it. Like they're such a big vertebrate, but if you put a small amount of venom into them, they actually have a natural reaction to it. So they don't get sick, but it's reacting on a cellular level. So you wouldn't see it from the outside looking in at the horse. But over a very long period, and we would do the same, like you start to build up that resistance. And that's all that anti-venom is it's the venom-resistant plasma in the blood. So they extract a vial of blood, they centrifuge it, they get the venom-resistant plasma out, and they put the red blood cells back in the horse, and he's straight back out in the paddock, and then that is what goes out to the hospitals. And, of course, it's specific to what snake bites you. So tiger snake, brown snake, taipan, death adder, and black snake.
Wow, I didn't even realize that was a thing. So, is this all antivenoms? They go to horses first?
Yes, except for, sorry, for spiders. For funnel-web spiders, it's large rabbits, because
Wow.
they're not even a rabbit you can keep as a pet in Australia. I can't remember the breed, but they're like massive, they're huge, and because they have a better immune response to the venom of a Sydney funnel-web spider.
That's
Yeah.
fascinating. There you go. Just goes to show you learn something new every day.
Oh yeah, 100% with that venom program is ridiculous.
So
Yeah, we.
obviously setting up that venom program is something that you have like started to achieve and work towards since you've had your new role. Do you have any other goals that you're hoping to achieve at ARP?
Yeah, I think to start with, I was just trying to get my head around the job, but and mentor the youngest, like all the staff. Like a lot of our team are younger, so I can say that. But yeah, just trying to make sure that they can get their head around things as well as keepers. But as far as the reptile park goes, I think we're very fortunate in the way that we're attached to AussieArc. It's like most zoos now. They've all got a branch of them that is conservation, and it's conservation focused. And of course, the reptile park is as well, but it pours its funds and any extra dollars it can, and also a lot of its attention and resources into AussieArc, the charity. So I think for us, we've got some select species. AussieArc are very good at doing, I guess, endemic natives is the focus. It's not because they've decided that overseas animals don't matter or don't need it. It's just that they think we can focus our attention here at home on things that are going to go extinct in the next little bit. So we've got a whole stack of mammals. Most famously, it started from the devil, the Tasmanian devil with his facial tumor disease. They got some of the very first devils ever to be brought onto mainland Australia from Tasmania back in 2007. But I guess at the park itself, we've got a branch of AussieArc called Conservation Arc, and that really focuses on three species of turtles: the Mannings, the Bells, and the Hunter River turtles. And then we've got two species of frogs and the broad-toothed rat, and we've just got our first broad-headed snakes, which is actually a very well-known, if you're from Sydney, it's a very well-known endangered snake down here, very closely related to your Stephen's banded snake up there, and we still get those down here. But they were absolutely poached out of house and home by heaps of young reptile enthusiasts back in the day. But also, I think more frustratingly, the rocks that they live on were taken for gardens around Sydney. So they lost their habitat completely, and pretty well localized extinctions are all over the place for them. So Conservation Arc, we call it, has got, we've now got, how many have we got? We've got 13 individual snakes that we're ready to breed. And when we breed them, we'll release them back onto these rocky escarpments, but they're going to get helicoptered into more remote rocky escarpment, and we're going to put out a whole bunch of artificial rock for them too. So I think the park itself, we've got the big ticket projects, like, yeah, Venom's about to open. And then down the track, I'm sure we've got big enclosure renovations to go. We want to still breed Komodos. We want to breed the King Cobras and do a lot of the fun stuff with our animals. But as far as the conservation projects, there are a lot of a good, I guess, achievable results we can get with the animals we've got, where we're breeding for release and putting them back in the wild. So at the moment, that's my focus. But yeah, and as operations manager, I guess I don't have to worry about big picture too much just yet.
That's
Yeah.
so cool, and it's amazing the steps that you guys are doing. You're really leading the way, especially in reptile conservation and natives, of course. And I really love how you mentioned about focusing in on natives, because we actually had a conversation at work the other day that was we were talking about how, you can go to some facilities in Australia and some of the massive exhibits and habitats are the exotic species. And possibly there's room for a lot more money to be going towards our natives, especially when we have such a high extinction rate in with our mammals. And I feel like there's a little bit of a gap missing with how much more money we could spend on our native species. So it's amazing to see what AussieArc have been able to do through ARP and the money that's been able to go to saving those animals.
100%, and it's crazy when you think about it. Hey, because you look at overseas, and we talk about orangutans and elephants and all the big ticket items that are under threat, but there's still, like, I can't remember how many orangutans are left, but it'd be in the thousands, isn't it? But you get to Australia and you deal with animals that are literally in the 20s to 100, like with our native animals. Like they're like, remember when northern hairy-nosed wombats only a few years ago were getting right down to less than 100. I think it got down to 35 or 40, correct me if I'm wrong, but and then they've managed to bounce and back up over 250. But yeah, like a lot of our species are just down to really small numbers, especially when you get into birds as well. And it's crazy. Like there's projections for a lot of our little lizards. A lot of those little earless dragons are going to be extinct in the next 20 to 30 years. And you go, how is that possible? And we're not pouring and investing into that. Like we always focus on overseas animals. And I think that's like, I guess, an easy thing to do. You grow up idolising what's overseas, but we forget about all the little brown furry things that are back home that not only are cute and cuddly and all that, and they're Australian, but they're so important. We forget what an ecological engineer a lot of these things are that we look after.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you're pretty new to this role, but is there a skill that you're hoping to develop in this new role?
Yeah, definitely. I guess being a supervisor, as a manager, I want to improve my skill as a mentor to everyone else that I'm sort of overseeing, and try and increase my, I guess, communication skills in that way. Like I'm so used to focusing on communicating with the public and with people about wildlife, but not so much to the team about how they can personally grow and try and inspire them so that they can come in and face the day no matter what challenges we've got in front of us. So yeah, I think that skill is really important, and I want to get down pat. And then I guess getting into the other aspects of the job like that I'm not used to. There's all the business, and I don't know how much I'll ever pick that stuff up, but the business side of it, budgeting, all of that, I think those skills I need to get a bit of a grip on, but I haven't tried to tackle them yet.
No, that's some good skills. I feel like the easy thing is the easiest thing about our job is working with the animals, right? When you have to deal with people, it like becomes so much harder and a little bit more challenging. So that's a good goal.
It's so much harder. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Well, we have a couple of questions from our listeners for you, Giffo. So are you happy to get into this?
Yeah, go for it. That's awesome.
Well, question number one is, what motivates and drives you?
Oh, what motivates and drives me? That is great. I guess the same as all of us. It started very young for me that, like, I think you're just interested and curious. You started out just fascinated by the world around you. And for that in particular, for me, it was wildlife and reptiles. But I guess as you grow older, you start to realize that the world around you is in trouble and there's a lot of animals that need our help. So that has been the driving force for me since I can remember. It's watching others that have taught me that there's a big wide world out there to look after. So David Ambrose, Steve Irwin, even more recently, I think Steve Backshaw would be another one that I've managed to lock onto to watch a few of his shows. But just for yourself, discovering how many animals there are out there and what is happening to the environment. I think it was in 2022 that there were 85 million hectares cleared in Queensland for cattle in 1 year. So like there's huge stats, and as soon as you start talking doom and gloom, people really switch off to it and they don't want to hear it and they put the blinders over. But it is true. There's a harsh reality out there that wildlife really needs our help. And so that motivates and drives me every single day, is that want to be there for animals for the rest of my life. And I think I was very fortunate to fall in love with wildlife because you don't have to retire from it. Everyone always talks about getting to a certain age where they can retire and that's it. But I don't ever see myself stopping with wildlife. Like you can get to any age with it. So it's always going to be there and it's always going to need our help.
Oh, that's such a good answer. I love that. It's very wholesome. Now, last question is, we've obviously spoken a lot about so many perks that we have with our job, but the last question we got was, what are the worst parts of the job that you have to kind of deal with?
The worst parts of the job?
Someone wants to know the tea.
Yeah, far out. They want to know the goss. the worst parts of the job are definitely the politics. Oh, I think the worst part of the job is having my fiance as as one of the people I oversee. That's tricky, especially once I get home, if I've gotten up at that day. Yeah. Then that changes the dynamic that night. But no, I think day to day, it is the politics that is the hardest part. Like you just said it, the animals are easy. Oh, and I used to think that far out, like obviously animal issues are the hardest when it comes to welfare. If there's something going wrong with animals, then that is the hardest part of your day by far. But generally, no, it's the people are much more complex. So dealing with politics, trying to make sure that we're getting the best out of the team, that they're expecting the best out of themselves. And then sometimes just dealing with difficult, angry, hot-tempered customers is also, that can be tricky as well. But and then the hardest part of the job, actually, you know what people don't give enough credit to, and we deal with it every day, is just the stress of it. And the smaller the facility, I feel like the harder it gets. And you've both like worked in, I guess, smaller facilities too, like Lone Pine, and I don't know if Sea Life gets the same, like. Does it get stressful? I don't know, even know if you
Yeah, I
can
mean
say it, but
it's a small team. It's a small team. So yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. Yeah, for sure.
So like, whereas I guess coming from a big zoo like Australia Zoo, you've got 15 people in your team, you share the load quite easily, but there's a lot of expectation and responsibility the smaller the team gets, and some days can be really hard and really stressful. And I think that kind of is good though, because it really builds you as a keeper. Like you can really see when someone has been to a smaller facility and they've got a lot more on their plate, because they can juggle their day and they can do it seamlessly with a smile on their face, and you have to. So I think that's pretty tricky, but definitely the people politics. If I'm dealing with like back in the roving days with fights, that is the hardest part of my day, because I
Oh, the
sometimes don't
drama.
know what to do. Yeah, it's like being back with my sisters. Yeah.
I think like everyone would say there's some degree of politics no matter where you work, and it can
Oh,
absolutely be so
100%.
challenging to not get
Yeah.
involved and stay neutral when you're everyone who works with animals are generally people who just care so much. So then that
Yes.
is comes through even more in politics. So you're
Oh.
just like, ah.
You put the biggest personalities in a zoo together and say, go for it. Yeah, it's 100%. But I must admit, like we talk it up, and I talk it up and say, yeah, it's busy and stressful and hard, and it can be. But at the same time, I look at what other people do for a living, and then I go, oh, far out, I feel a lot better. It's pretty easy work, you know, after a moment. So I remember one bloke was in my last job getting so wound up, and he gets so angry at people, and he swear and curse and get so fired up. And I'd say, mate, we're working in a family-friendly zoo. We're not flying in a Chinook to the Taliban. We're working at a zoo. Like it is actually pretty a pretty good day when you actually think about
Yeah, I think that's like a really good thing to remember that we have a pretty good gig what we do and like the stress,
it.
you know. It's yeah, we're very lucky with everything. Well, Gipo, it has
Absolutely.
been such an honor having you on Trying to Talk Some Tales, and I feel so blessed to have been a little bit of part of your journey and your career, and I cannot wait to see what the future holds for you because I know it's going to hold some pretty big things.
Oh, thank you so much. And Mick and Nero better have listened to this and written down everything I've said and taken a lot of notes,
I'm
especially for
sure they'll
Wildlife
support
Unleashed.
you.
Yeah. No, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it. And you too are shining lights in the zoo industry for us. I'm just happy to have you as mates as well. Like I've learned so much off, particularly you, Dazo, working with you closely. And Tessa, I've learned off her Instagram, and Cassie do a very cute back video as well as all of the birds of prey. But far out, like you two are absolutely killing it. And even just this in itself, connecting the zoo industry, or even just people generally interested in all animals, is massive. So yeah, thanks for letting me be a part of it and for thinking
Thank
of
you
me. I love it.
for joining us. It's been great to have you as our last guest of the year. So it's been awesome. Thank you so much, Gippo.
Ah,
Thanks,
thank you.
Gippo.
See yous, Farouk.
Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. Like we mentioned, it was our last one of the year, and Giffo, he was just so excited and so passionate about his reptiles, and he's pretty inspiring to think that he's worked really hard for those roles and is obviously doing really well. So hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I agree. His passion is so infectious, and he's such a great character to be around. And I'm sure, you know, people would have definitely learned some really cool stuff from Giffo. So we really hope that you enjoyed that one. And just again, like, thank you so much to everyone who's tuned in this year. We are so, so grateful for all of you listening and for your continued support. We hope you have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we will see you in 2025.
See you in 2025. Merry Christmas.